What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. I'm your host, Katie Helper, and I'm joined every week by my co-host, Gabe Pacheco. You can hear the Katie Helper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI, that's 99.5 FM, or WBAI.org. You can also find us on SoundCloud and iTunes, where you can rate and review us. Don't forget that we count on your support to bring you our weekly shows. To do that, just go to patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Today's episode of The Katie Helper Show is really exciting. It's a double header, double whammy. We bring you two interviews. They're both really important. One has more of a local focus and one has more of a national one. First, I bring you my interview with Reverend Kader El-Yatim. He's a candidate for city council in Brooklyn's 43rd district. He's also a Lutheran pastor, Arab American, proud immigrant, socialist, father of four. Then we bring you a debate over the best way to achieve universal health care between Dr. Adam Gaffney and journalist Joshua Holland. Interestingly enough, Reverend Kader El-Yatim is endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America. And you know who else is running for city council and received the endorsement of the DSA? Glad you asked, Jabari Brisport. And you can see Jabari at our next live taping of The Katie Helper Show, which will be Monday, September 18th at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons at 388 Atlantic Avenue. As always, it will be followed by karaoke. So we're so excited to be talking to Reverend Kader El-Yatim, who is a candidate for city council in the 43rd district. He is your typical Lutheran pastor, Arab American, Palestinian born, proud immigrant, father of four, city council candidate. I know there's so many of those, so it's hard to keep up, but we're really excited to be talking to him, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Can you tell us a little bit about what made you get involved in the campaign?
Well, I always been engaged and involved in the community. I served in community board 12 years. I served on many different boards, many different organizations in the neighborhood, such as the Arab American Association of New York. But during the last election, it is where I became more engaged and involved and inspired by the Bernie Sanders campaign and the platform he was talking about. And he was able to motivate me, engage me, speaks about issues that are relative to me. And after the election of Trump, I became very alarmed about the rhetoric that's coming out from the White House. And when this seat became open, I wanted to be engaged and involved in a bigger, higher level, and I decided to run for city council so we can bring a bold, inclusive leadership to the district where I felt it was missing in the past many years.
And can you tell us a little bit about what you were doing up until now with your life?
Well, as you mentioned at the beginning, I am a Lutheran pastor who decided not to be only a minister to his church, but also to be a community activist and leader and organizer. So all my life in this community was about building bridges, bringing people together. I reached out to my Muslim brothers and sisters, as well as my Jewish brothers and sisters, and we formed together something called Unity Task Force. And the whole idea of it, to come together around the table, to know each other as neighbors, but to work on issues of concern in the community and respond to them collectively. So that has been very, very important initiative in the community, especially after the events of 9/11, where we came together to continue to keep the peace and the harmony in the community, but also to make sure no one in our community will be attacked, harassed, or victimized for the language they speak or the way they look. So that's really a part of my legacy in this community.
And in terms of your campaign, I was just looking at your kind of some of your issues, and you're committed to better transportation, making transportation more accessible, protecting seniors, cutting red tape that prevents seniors from accessing government programs and benefits, and leading the fight against prescription drug price increases, keeping the neighborhood affordable, fighting illegal conversions, establishing programs to help victims practice, addressing untenable rent costs for small businesses, advocating for citywide affordable housing plan that is actually affordable, public safety and better policing, advocate for resources for local precincts and end all unofficial ticketing quotas to stop for-profit policing, pass the Right to Know Act and supporting new immigrants. And, oh, this is interesting, increased funding for ESEOL, English for speakers of other languages.
We need to make sure we are providing the resources for people so they can learn English, they can assimilate, they can get engaged, they can get involved. And by creating these opportunities, actually, we are empowering immigrant communities to thrive. And I think providing these resources would be extremely important to that process.
Great. And where did you learn English so well, by the way?
Well, when I came to this country, I spent the first year studying English. So in Philadelphia.
So can you tell us a little bit about your early life, I guess, and your trajectory, how you even came to the United States?
Well, I was born and raised in Bethlehem. I'm a Palestinian from Palestinian origins, and I was born and raised there. In 1992, I was sent to the United States to be a mission developer to start the first Arabic-speaking Lutheran congregation in North America, and I was brought to Brooklyn.
Wow, I didn't realize that. That's really cool.
Why I came to the United States is to reach out to the Arab Christians who left the Middle East and came to the United States and called the United States their new home. And many of them came to Brooklyn, and I was sent here to minister to them.
Before that, you had been ministering in Bethlehem, or...?
Yeah, I was working at the Bethlehem Bible College, but I came to the United States in 1992. I went to Philadelphia. I finished my Master of Divinity. Then I came to Brooklyn in 1995.
And is there a large Lutheran population in Palestine?
It's not very large. There is... couple of thousands, and we have a lot of families left because of the poor living conditions back home.
Right.
Because of, we live under the Israeli occupation, that's one. Economy is very bad, there is no security, and people just leaving the land to look for a better future for their children, which is a very sad reality. And that's when the church realized that the people who are moving here, they did not have a home to... a spiritual home, and that's why I was sent here.
Wow, that's great. And how does being Palestinian influence your politics or your worldview?
Well, you know, I was born and raised under the Israeli occupation. All my life I lived in a home where I was always sheltered and protected, not to go outside after dark, always been watched when I go out and come in, when I go to school. You know, the situation was always dangerous, and it can change in a split of a second. When I was at the age of 19, I was actually arrested by the Israeli soldiers and was imprisoned for almost 2 months. And that experience really impacted my life and made me ask the question, why this is happening to me? Why this injustice? Why this pain and suffering? Why I have to be in a prison when I know I did not do anything? And when I came out from prison, I really committed my life and myself to work on issues of justice and peace and to understand the behavior of the other and why they try to act in such a way. And that's why I wanted to be engaged in dialogue and to know the other. And I actually, since then, I've been engaged in many peace conferences where Israelis and Palestinians come together to engage each other about the occupation, the uprising, what's happening back there, and how we can work collectively together, try to bring some sense and some understanding in the chaos of what's happening back home.
Great. And what were you arrested for, if I can ask?
I have no idea. I was picked up from my bed at 3 a.m.
Wow.
I never was given any reason, and I was released after 57 days without knowing why I was arrested.
Oh my gosh. And your parents, your family, I assume they were not told what had happened. How did they, they didn't need to give any explanation?
Home, yeah, back home, really, I mean, for the first 18 days after my arrest, nobody knew where I was. I did not know where I was.
Wow.
And no lawyer will come visit you. The first time I saw my lawyer, it was after 18 days. And the lawyer was only to come say hello, bring you maybe a change of clothes, where I was not allowed to use anyway.
Wow.
And but there is no court, there is nothing. I was in a small cell in solitary confinement for 57 days by myself.
What?
Every day, yeah. Every day I was questioned, every day I was tortured, every day I was subjected to different horrifying experiences, because they wanted me to confess something that I did not know what it was.
Wow.
So it was a very, very difficult experience in my life. I mean, for somebody who's 19 to be in a solitary confinement for 57 days without taking a shower or changing my clothes or shaving my beard or cutting my nails, not able to speak to anybody except to the people who are torturing me and interrogating me, it was a very difficult experience.
God. Wow.
And that's where I start questioning even my faith and questioning myself. And that's where I start asking the serious questions. Why this is happening, and I wanted to understand why this is happening. Unfortunately, I couldn't make sense of it then, but you know, it is always very difficult when you see the victim becomes the victimizer.
Right.
So that's part of where I was. The victim became the victimizers. And you know, when the Jews came out of Europe after the Second World War and they came to Palestine, they were accepted and welcomed. They were our neighbors. Unfortunately, the political climate changed very quickly after the 1948 war. But when they came before the 1948, everybody gave them land and they lived and they went to each other's weddings.
Right.
I remember growing up in Bethlehem in my house, and my father was a carpenter who will do the olive wood carvings, the nativity scenes and the camels and the donkeys. And I will wake up and I see all these Israelis at our house to purchase my father's merchandise.
Wow.
To sell it to the tourists. But they will refuse to leave our house till my great-grandmother finished baking the bread in the clay oven so they can eat and take with them.
Wow.
That's how I grew up. But things also changed very quickly when the uprising started.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. When you were arrested and you were tortured and kidnapped, basically, right? It's kidnapping.
Yeah, I was taken out from my bed at 3 a.m.
And you were religious then? How religious were you at this point?
I just finished my high school when I was 17. It was my second year in college, and I was studying at the Bethlehem Bible College, preparing my theological education to become a minister.
I was about to say Jesus Christ, not even joking. I'm not even kidding. That came into my, I just started saying that, and then I realized,
So after I finished high school, I really wanted to become a priest. And I belonged at that time for the Greek Orthodox Church.
Oh.
Yeah, so I spoke to my priest who took me to Jerusalem to meet with the patriarch. And the patriarch said, well, we don't have money to send you to be educated now. And very soon I became to realize that I wasn't living only under one occupation, which is the Israeli occupation, but I was living under two occupations. The Israeli occupation of Palestine and the Greek occupation of the indigenous Palestinian church.
Wow.
So here we have a Palestinian church where the whole hierarchy and the whole leadership is Greeks.
Wow.
Who controlling the money, controlling the properties, controlling the income, stealing everything, and the local indigenous Palestinian church is suffering. And that's when I decided to leave the Greek Orthodox Church because I couldn't call that church home for me anymore. Because I feel there's a foreign leadership that it just doesn't care about the suffering and the pain of the Palestinian people.
So you were raised Greek Orthodox?
Yes.
That's what you were brought up in?
Yes.
And your parents are that also?
They still are part of the Greek Orthodox Church, but I left the Greek Orthodox Church and I joined the Lutheran Church.
Okay, and so you were going to do religious study, you were doing it, but you were started off as part of the Orthodox Church, then you joined the Lutheran Church.
Yes.
And then you are kidnapped, arrested, tortured. Where is that in this chronology? Just to get
that was in my second year of college at the Bethlehem Bible College.
Okay, so you're already Lutheran at this point?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So you went to jail, you suffered all of that, and you didn't come out an atheist. You didn't come out a radical, I don't know, misanthrope. You didn't embrace violence. I mean, was it hard to not do that? I feel like these experiences can either, I guess, they reaffirm someone's faith or they can, you know, kill their faith.
Yeah. I mean, as I told you, it was really very difficult experience in my life in which, made me question my faith and why this is happening to me and where is God in the midst of all this. But, I very quickly came to realize that the only thing that's sustaining me in the prison was my faith. And the conversation I have with God through my prayers. That's really what sustained me in the prison and kept me strong and kept me going. Because the fact is, because of the torture and the psychological warfare in prison, many people just crash and just say anything to get out of the cell, and they will be sentenced for a year or two, just will sit in a big prison. And I made a commitment to myself. I'm not going to say anything that I haven't done. And I suffered tremendously because of that decision. But at the end, I was released without being convicted.
Wow. And so then you just continued where you left off? I mean, did you need to take time to
recuperate? You know, after I left the prison, people come and they treat you as a hero because you survived the Israeli prisons. And, you know, many people came and approached me. Listen, see what happened to you. Now it's the time to resist and to carry arms against Israel. And we have to do this and that. And I said, I am not interested in this at all. I am interested in one thing. I need to understand and I need to figure out what is happening. And that's really when I started educating myself. I start researching. I start going to meetings where in Jerusalem, where I knew there is Palestinians and Israelis are meeting and they are talking about difficult issues through dialogue. I became involved. And when I came here in the United States, my church actually held the first dialogue circle to bring Jews and Palestinians together to speak about the conflict in the Middle East.
Wow. So what does the conflict in the Middle East have to do with being a council person in New York City?
I think my experience over there empowers my commitment to issues of justice and peace. It empowers my commitment to fight for those who are marginalized and being pushed on the side. My whole campaign is about bringing people to the middle of the table to make sure everyone is empowered, organized, given a voice, given representation. I don't want the elected officials that in our district just to deal with the rich and the elite and people who are they are poor or they hardworking families don't have the voice to represent them. So my campaign is a grassroots campaign. It's from the people for the people. I have hundreds of diverse volunteers who come and they are invested in this campaign. They are committed to this campaign. They are stakeholders in this campaign because they want to see there's a strong leadership coming in here to fight for issues of justice, to bring a bold, inclusive voice, to give everyone representation and to make sure everybody is given the chance. So my campaign is not only about me going to city council, is creating a political movement in Southwest Brooklyn. It's about engaging people and let them come, mobilize them, and be engaged in the political process. That's why throughout my campaign, we have registered over 600 new voters.
Wow.
I mean, that is an amazing achievement that we have been able to do. To engage over 600 new voters in this district, I think that is building political power. And the elected officials who are from the status quo, they have to understand your status quo is not working in this neighborhood and change is coming.
So what makes you different from the Democrats you're running against in the primary?
What makes me different is really the commitments that I have made in this campaign. First, I made a commitment that I will not take any developers' money. I will not take any corporate lobbyist money. My campaign is about engaging everyone, involving everyone, empowering everyone, giving everyone a voice. I am not a career politician. I am not from the establishment, so I will be able to go and stand up when things are not right, and I will support them when they are right. When Mayor de Blasio do something wrong, I will hold him accountable. I will stand and use every power I have to make sure he is doing the right thing for the people of our great city. And that's really what makes me different, being from outside the establishment, who does not owe any favors to anybody, who doesn't have a political post or a party that or establishment I have to please. I will go as a free person to city council to make the right decisions to serve the people who live in the district.
And it's interesting because you and Jabari Brisport have both been endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA. Yes. Do you think that there's a, why do you think the DSA is taking off so much and socialism in general?
When I heard about the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, I was really impressed. I felt that the things that I believe in, my convictions, my passion, it found a home with the DSA. I have been in this district for the past 22 years. I never found a political club that I can belong to. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the political clubs we have in this district is like exclusive clubs for certain people who look the same way, who speak the same language. It has no diversity. It has no commitment and passion about issues of justice, especially when it comes to economic justice and social justice and racial justice. And I feel the DSA is a great place where I can personally belong, but also they are speaking about relative issues, fighting for everyone in our city. They are not accountable as me to establishment, but they are accountable to the issues of justice and to the people that will benefit from our movement and from our fight.
Who made that meme of you or GIF on the skateboard?
I have no idea. We received a message from Bob Cabano, who's a Republican candidate running in the primaries. And he wrote about me that I am a leftist radical Palestinian cleric. And we wanted to respond to him by something radical to say, so we did this, I am on the skateboard pointing at him. And at the end of the video, we'll say radical cleric. Khadr Al Yatim for City Council.
It's pretty great. He may have inspired one of your best videos.
It was ironically a great video. We took the video front of the office, and I'm not sure who worked on it, to be honest with you. So I wanted to respond to him with something radical.
Yeah, exactly. So Bob Capano, a fighter for lower taxes and leading Republican City Council candidate for the 43rd District, which is Bay Ridge, Diker Heights, Bensonhurst, Bath Beach, today called upon the Democrat candidates running for the 43rd Council District seat to denounce the endorsement of their fellow candidate, Palestinian cleric Khadr Al Yatim, by the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. Capano called the endorsement, quote, a clear signal that Al Yatim's political views are out of touch with Brooklyn and the nation, end quote. So that's kind of like a great endorsement, actually, when you get
it's fantastic. I'm very proud of that endorsement.
Yeah, you should put it on the top of your website. And in terms of endorsements, you've been endorsed by New York State Nurses Association, Luna, New York, Councilman Carlos Menchaca, Tenants PAC, New Kings Democrats, New York State Immigrant Action Fund, Muslim Democratic Club of New York, New York City Democratic Socialists, National Institute for Reproductive Health Action Fund. You received an 100% candidate rating from Planned Parenthood Action Fund, yes. League of Independent Theater, that's interesting,
yeah.
Small Business Congress, and Sierra Club. Yeah, so do you do any theater and acting?
Well, the reason I mean, that was really important endorsement for me because we in our district, we don't have any community centers.
Mm.
And I wanted to make sure when I am elected to city council, I will open the first community center where we'll bring people who are from different ethnicities, different religions, where we can be engaged through art and performances and programs and gardening. So we can build the bridges and get people to know each other, to know their neighbors, to find a safe place where they can interact. Unfortunately, this opportunity is not created in our community, and this community center will be able to bring all of us together. The most important thing to me through this community center is to create the opportunity and the safe place where we can speak about difficult issues in the community, where we can speak about issues that really, for example, when it comes down to speak about, let's say, Planned Parenthood, what they stand for, why we should support them. When we speak about the LGBTQ community, you know, we have a lot of people who disagree, people who agree, people who don't get the chance to speak about it without being judged. And we need to create these safe places where the community members can come and speak about it. But most importantly, I want to make sure I am bringing the long-term residents to meet with the new immigrants, to get to engage in a positive conversation, to learn about each other's cultures and language and build and form friendships, instead of us saying, these are new immigrants and everything goes wrong in our community because of these new immigrants. So I think this community center will be vital to the peace and harmony in the community.
And what about, do you identify as a socialist?
Yes, I do, and I'm very proud of it.
Nice. And when did you start identifying as a socialist? Or when did you discover socialism?
You know, I think I always considered myself socialist, but it became official, I think, in around February of this year.
Mm-hmm. What does socialism mean to you?
It's very simple. Socialism is about working hand in hand for the sake of our brothers and sisters to improve their life conditions. Is the fact that you are willing to step out of your comfort place and stand in a picket line to defend the worker, to fight for economic justice for those who are less fortunate, and to fight for social justice. That's really what it means. It means that we are working very hard to make sure everyone in our city, in our world, is being lifted up and taken care of. And that's really what it means to me.
In terms of policies, are there any major differences between you and the Democrats? I mean, you explained very well that you are not as beholden to the establishment and to political elites. Are there any areas in terms of policies or plans or positions where there's a big gap between you and your opponents?
I think the biggest difference, I speak about affordable housing. And when I speak about affordable housing, I speak about housing that is affordable to the people who live here. Unfortunately, we have a lot of people are on the verge of becoming homeless because they cannot afford the rent anymore. So I want to go and fight and bring the funding to our district so we can build affordable housing in our district. And we want to make sure we are fighting to make sure that taxes don't go up. We have seniors in our district who lived in their homes for 50 and 60 years. They are finding themselves now they cannot afford to stay in their homes because the taxes going up. Water rates are going up, and they are in fixed incomes and saying to me, we can't stay in our home anymore. Hmm. So that's number one when it comes to our district, which make me unique. But also I am when I am elected to city council, every decision we make in city council will impact the life of everyone in the city, not only in my district. That's why I want to make sure when I go to city council, we continue to fight to pass the Right to Know Act, and to make sure we are ending the broken window policing.
Can you explain what the Right to Know Act is?
The Right to Know Act, there is two sections to it. It's about police accountability, where police officers will have to identify themselves to any person they stop if that stop does not result in an arrest, and give them their number, their rank, and everything. But the most important part of that legislation that the police officer must inform the person who is in a car that they have the right to refuse for their car to be searched. Mm. I mean, the problem is we see that people of color, immigrants, undocumented in our city, usually the first target when it comes down to the relationship with the police. And, you know, we have to be truthful to ourselves that there are certain privileges to certain people. So if some person stopped and that person is black, you might end up in Rikers. And if that same person stopped for the same a crime and their skin color is different, they might be let go free. So that's why we're calling on police accountability and ending the broken window policing, passing the Right to Know Act, I think will be a major achievement in that way.
It was. It's interesting, I guess, looping back to the question of religion and politics. Mm-hmm. It was really moving to see Bernie Sanders talk at Riverside Church, where Martin Luther King had, of course, delivered his Beyond Vietnam speech.
Yep.
Have you been to Riverside Church in the past?
Yes, many times.
Yeah, it's really pretty moving. There's so many people who use religion in a kind of reactionary, bigoted way, or to justify reactionary, bigoted politics. Do you ever find people who are just turned off by religion or don't trust religious leaders because of the way that religion has often been kind of abused?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I am sometimes turned off by religion when I see the white supremacists, the KKK, and the neo-Nazis using religion in a way to hate people and victimize people and be racist.
Right.
That's when I'm turned off by religion.
Right.
Even when I look at what's happening in the Middle East, where ISIS and Al-Qaeda use religion to commit their acts of violence against innocents. And the victims of their crimes actually are mostly Muslims, not even Christians or Jews. So religion,
right,
is to me, is a beautiful thing to empower us to be bold in our relationship to the other. It is a beautiful thing to allow us to feel the pain of the other and to work to help others. That's really religion, what it's to me. Otherwise, religion is outside of this, I'm not sure if it has any meaning.
Mm. Why is religion important to you? Like, what is it about the teachings of Jesus Christ that are important to not just someone who believes in Jesus Christ, but to everyone?
Well, my whole understanding of my Christian faith is my relationship to the other. So my faith empowers me to step outside of my comfort, step outside of my identity, so I can connect and see the identity of the other. It is about knowing who is the other, feeling their pain, hearing their story, understanding their context, and how we can work together to improve the human life's condition. So I look at Jesus as the biggest socialist in the world, who worked mm-hmm. for social justice, who wanted to bring economic justice. And I take my message as an empowerment to be able to fight for issues of justice and to stand on the side of those who are victimized, those who are harassed, those who are facing domestic violence or hate crimes or racist anti-discrimination crimes. So my faith really empowers me to be able to do things that otherwise I would not be able to do without having a confidence that I am doing something good for the sake of helping my neighbor.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of what's the point of it.
Yeah.
And have you been back to Bethlehem?
I go every 3 years, 4 years, but it is a very difficult trip. I am an American citizen, but Israel mm-hmm. does not recognize my American citizenship.
Mm.
So I am not allowed to use my American passport to travel to Israel. So what I have to do is travel from here to Jordan, and then I have to travel from Jordan to the Palestinian territories through land. And when I go there, I have to use only my Palestinian travel document.
Mm.
Yeah, so... which is makes it a little bit tough.
By the way, I put out on Twitter, I said, I'm chatting with you, and I said, does anyone have any questions?
Uh-huh.
And James Zogby wrote, no questions, but tell him I think he's great.
Thank you.
So that's nice. And what do people need to do to support you right now?
Well, we have been working for the past 8 months nonstop, and it has been so exciting. It's phenomenal. We have hundreds of diverse volunteers who come and volunteer with us. The DSA has done incredible job to bring their volunteers here. So we need people to come out on September 12th and volunteer for us to make sure we get people to go out and vote. So my one ask for everyone who is listening to us today is take September 12th off, come to the district, get engaged, get involved, help us get the votes out, and let's make things happen.
Great. You have 4 kids, right?
Yes.
And you have how many dogs?
One dog.
A Yorkie. Max is his name?
My favorite, Max.
How old is he?
He just turned 4 in July.
Oh my gosh, it's my birthday too. It's 7-11, July 11th.
Here you go.
Okay, well, thank you so much. This was really great. I could keep talking forever.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Great, thank you.
You're listening to The Katie Halper Show on WBAI. Don't forget that we count on your support to bring you our weekly shows. To do that, just go to patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. That was our interview with Kader El-Yateem, who is running for city council. To find out more about Reverend Kader El-Yateem, please go to elyateem2017.com. That's elyateem2017.com. That is ELYATEEM2017. Reverend El-Yateem is a supporter of single payer, by the way. And speaking of which, now we bring you our healthcare debate. John Conyers' Medicare for All bill has 115 Democratic sponsors in the House. And next week, Senator Bernie Sanders will be presenting his own Senate version. But what exactly is Medicare for All? And is it the best way to achieve universal health care coverage? To find out, I invited on two special guests, Dr. Adam Gaffney and Mr. Joshua Holland.
And this is our Katie Halper Show debate, some hot left-on-left action. And we're speaking to Adam Gaffney and Joshua Holland. Adam Gaffney is a writer, instructor at Harvard Medical School, a pulmonary and critical care doctor, and a single-payer advocate with Physicians for a National Health Care Plan. He writes for places like Jacobin and The Guardian.
So really what we're talking about now is politics and about some of the policy details of how to actually achieve the goal of universal health care.
Joshua Holland is a Nation Institute fellow, and he writes for places like The Nation and Rolling Stone. And he's the host of Politics and Reality Radio.
Those advocating a rapid transition of everybody into a single-payer healthcare program are ignoring what I think is the biggest obstacle, which is the public.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Katie.
Thanks for having us, Katie.
Yeah, of course. So you both wrote pieces about Medicare for All, and you guys kind of had opposing theses, I would say. So Josh, your piece, which was in The Nation, is titled Medicare for All Isn't the Solution for Universal Healthcare. The healthcare debate is moving to the left, but if progressives don't start sweating the details, we're going to fail yet again. Adam, on the other hand, you wrote a piece called Medicare for All Should Be a Litmus Test. Don't believe the critics. Medicare for All is the most realistic way to win universal, equitable healthcare. Now, okay, and that was a Jacobin. I wanted to do a test. An intellectual exercise and also an exercise in understanding and dialogue. What if each of you explained the other one's arguments and then got into the debate, but make the best case as if you, Josh, were Adam and Adam, you were Josh, or you were arguing for what Josh was arguing and you were arguing for what Adam was arguing?
This comes from like debate, I think, training 101.
Is this really obvious?
I feel like we're getting a little dirty hippie-ish here.
Well,
I mean, do we need to sing kumbaya?
Well, here, let me tell you why. I mean, this is the kumbaya.
I was just
going to
go straight for the jugular, but I can do this.
I mean, I will sing kumbaya, by the way. I'm not denigrating.
I'm not singing anything.
I had a debate last year. I had a debate about Bernie versus Hillary among women, like, you know, the feminist debate.
God.
And I started out by having each of the women participating tell me a good thing for the person that they were opposing. In other words, like, I actually had Amanda Marcotte say why Bernie was a good choice, and I had, you know, Sarah Leonard say why Hillary was a good choice. And it was just interesting. Now,
Katie, we're white men. We're socialized for aggression.
I know. Well, so are some of the women on the panel, including myself.
No, Katie, you're so conciliatory. You never fight with anybody.
You know, in real life,
I've never seen it.
In real life, I am.
I've never.
I avoid conflict.
I appreciate your pugilistic style, actually.
But it's not just pugilistic.
I know.
It's become more and more. Anyway, so you guys don't like my idea?
I mean, we could, you know, we could reduce the debate down to the nub of it also, because I'm happy to stipulate that single payer is superior and that, you know, if I were a benevolent dictator for a day, there's no question that I would enact Medicare for all and just stick everybody in it.
Yeah.
So we don't really have to debate that piece of
it. So you're saying on a moral, ethical level, you agree that Medicare for all is the best. But your critique is strategic.
Why don't I just kind of like throw out my...
All right, fine.
Like a little bit of my thesis. Do you want to do this, Adam?
If you don't want to do it.
I mean, I can summarize Josh's argument. It's up to you. Or we can just summarize our own arguments. I don't know. It's up to you. You two decide.
I mean, I kind of think that, you know, you're... By the way, Adam wrote the best critique of my piece out there. But I think that you missed... I think that you did not address a really central point. I believe that Medicare for All is terrific politics, and I believe that there are a number of different ways to get to something that we could call a single-payer system. Single-payer is kind of a fuzzy term, but I've noticed since I wrote this piece that a lot of people who are single-payer advocates, I mean, not wonky advocates, but just regular lefty activist types who say they demand single-payer actually want universal health care, comprehensive universal health care, and are not as concerned about how you get there as one might think. That's been something that I've an interesting revelation, and people have actually accused me of a straw man in suggesting that people are set on Medicare, a rapid transition to Medicare for all. Anyway, my belief is that all of the obstacles that others talk about, feckless Democrats, healthcare industry stakeholders, the insurance industry, are going to be exactly as great an obstacle as others believe. But I believe that the left is also, those advocating a rapid transition of everybody into a single-payer healthcare program are ignoring what I think is the biggest obstacle, which is the public. And what I talk about in the piece is this idea of loss aversion. People value something that they have more than they value something that they might get. Even if that thing is superior, there is another phenomenon known as status quo bias. People are afraid of change, especially rapid change. The more rapid, the more resistance you'll get. And I think that there are ways to get to something that might be called single payer that avoid some of these pitfalls. And if we bite it all off in one chunk, we are basically going to fail. That's a nutshell of my argument.
Okay. And so for you, Adam misses the loss aversion and the status quo bias.
Well, so in Adam's piece, which again was, I thought, the best critique of my piece, he explains why single payer Medicare for all, as it's on the table in the Conyers bill, would be superior, would give people better benefits. And then he says, who wouldn't want that? So he posits that this would be a rational conversation, and he kind of wishes away my arguments about loss aversion as if people are politically rational about these choices, when loss aversion is actually irrational. And it's not something that I made up. It's a very well-established psychological principle. I had in an earlier draft of the piece that got cut for length, I talked about some experiments. A very famous one was they gave people $50 and they said, you can keep $30 or you can take a 50-50 gamble and you get to keep it all or lose it all. And a minority of respondents or subjects decided to take that gamble. And when they changed the wording from you can keep $30 to you can lose $20, which is the same amount of money, the number of people who wanted to gamble went up significantly because they were so, the idea of loss triggered something in them. They acted differently. And of course, the rational response to a 50-50 chance of getting $25 or 100% chance of getting $30 is you keep the $30. So this just changing the wording caused a dramatic change in people's behavior. Another example is they asked people to value an object. And they'd say like, oh, I think it's worth about $5. And then later in the experiment, they gave them that object. And they asked how much they would have to be given to lose it. How much, you know, how much do you want for it? And their valuation of it significantly increased when they owned it. So this is not something that I just made up. It's not rational. It is what it is. And the other point that I'd make, and I'll turn this over to Adam in a second, is that we've just seen such a clear example of that with the Affordable Care Act process. The Affordable Care Act, for all its flaws, extended health coverage to 15 times as many people as lost policies, quote unquote lost policies. About 1.5 million people were unable to keep their policy, you know, contrary to Obama's famous promise. And those people became a huge scandal and really just a centerpiece of the opposition, even though those policies were by and large substandard, catastrophic care policies that wouldn't even cover them if they got sick. And most of those people were able to get more comprehensive coverage with subsidies that ended up making it a wash. So in any rational universe, these 1.5 million so-called victims of Obamacare shouldn't have been a big deal, but the idea of losing coverage is a really big deal.
Okay.
All right. So a lot of points wrapped into one, into what Josh has said. Let me just say at the outset that I do think that me and Josh are arguing, or we believe in, from a moral perspective, the same long-term goal of creating a right to health care in this country. And it seems like we agree on even the policy merits of single payer. So really what we're talking about now is politics and about some of the policy details of how to actually achieve the goal of universal health care. I think one thing that's important to say right now is that Josh misses a very larger problem in the U.S. healthcare system. We're not just talking about the uninsured. 9% of the country right now remains uninsured in the age of the Affordable Care Act, 28.6 million, according to the National Health Interview Survey last year. That is a serious problem. I think we can both agree that is something we need to deal with, we have to deal with, and it's morally imperative that we deal with as soon as possible. We can't leave all these people without healthcare coverage in any decent society. But that's not the only problem. Okay, there are multiple other serious shortcomings in the American healthcare system, and nothing that Josh says would deal with everybody else's problems. So, for instance, people who are getting their insurance through their employers. The Kaiser Health Family Foundation has estimated that they've had a 300% increase in the dollar value of their deductible over the last decade. People are being hit with co-payments, deductibles, co-insurance that are squeezing their finances, that are making it difficult to avoid health to attain health care, that are making them defer health care, and that are squeezing household finances in a serious way. Prescription drugs is a whole other issue. Maybe it's not fair to go into that right now, but that's another area that does need to be addressed, and a single payer system would address it, whereas the incremental approaches would not. There are even problems with Medicare. I mean, Medicare, even though I'm the one advocating for Medicare for All system, we're talking about expanded and improved Medicare. I think there are problems with Medicare. It also leaves people with too much healthcare expenditures out of pocket, as well as excludes important benefits. So before we get into some of the nitty gritty about the loss aversion things, and I want to respond to all of Josh's points, I think it's important that we realize that we have a slightly different philosophical orientation towards this whole thing. Many of us in the Medicare for All movement are aiming at improving the healthcare system for everybody in the population, almost everyone, not only the uninsured. We care about the uninsured, and that's critical and that's central, but there's other important things that we need to do. And unlike the incremental approaches, Medicare for All, expanded and improved Medicare for All, has the capacity to improve healthcare for the vast majority of the country. So that's one point I want to make at the outset. Now, regarding loss aversion, there's something actually very important that I think we can learn from Josh's article, which is that he is right. If we establish a single payer system in which the single payer plans are inferior to current employer-based plans, we will have a problem on our hands. okay? If we are talking about moving the entirety of employer-sponsored covered people with employer-sponsored coverage into a plan that's inferior, as he does suggest in the article, that is going to be politically insurmountable potentially. So we absolutely need to design a single-payer system without cost sharing, in my opinion. I think that that will be an enormous selling point for all the people that Josh are talking about. If people learn that they're going to obtain a plan without co-payments or deductibles, that is going to be an enormously strong argument for them to favor being transitioned and accepting a Medicare for All system. Let me also speak to a couple other reasons why I think the loss aversion argument is not really the right one. Not only in a Medicare for All system, not only would people not have cost sharing, according to the HR 676 bills, as well as what I believe will be in Sanders' upcoming bill, there'll also be the end of insurance networks. People don't like being told what doctor they have to go to, what hospital they have to go to. We talk a lot about choice, but people don't have choice today. They have insurer choice, but they don't have actual choice in their doctors. So under a Medicare for All system, we'd eliminate networks. We'd have one big network so that people could actually choose their doctor in the hospital. I think that would provide a very compelling, meaningful arguments for people to want Medicare for All as opposed to incremental approaches or opposed to keeping their current plan. The third thing I'd say in response to Josh mentioning that, you know, people who were on the ACA, when we implemented the ACA, some people lost their existing plans. And as Josh mentioned, that created a whole political stir. But I don't think the argument is really fair. The reality is that those people essentially had their premiums go up. Now, they were, as Josh said, getting much better plans. The Affordable Care Act had more requirements for coverage, 10 essential health benefits, etc. The plans that they had were basically catastrophic plans. I think from some people's perspectives, all they saw was their premiums go up, and they weren't really thinking 30 years down the road when they might have more expenses, they might actually benefit from this transition. But from their perspective, they just saw premiums rising, and they thought that it was something bad. Look, it's going to be a massive fight no matter what. There's going to be a lot of resistance. No matter what you do, we're going to be going up against the insurers, the pharmaceutical companies. The right-wing media is going to spin it like crazy. We're going to be called everything in the book. This isn't going to be easy no matter how you approach it. The reality is, though, is that – and I'll go back to Josh now. The reality is that only a Medicare for All system would improve healthcare for everybody. And it's important that we improve healthcare for everybody because we need to have a huge coalition to coalesce together in order to see something this big happen. And I think that this could be an important rallying cry for Democrats as well. It's going to be part of a larger political project because it includes everyone and potentially would help everyone.
You're listening to The Katie Halper Show on WBAI. To hear the rest of this debate between Adam Gaffney and Josh Holland, please become Patreon supporters. To do that, just go to patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Adam is a single-payer advocate, a member of Physicians for a National Healthcare Plan. You can find out more about Adam at his website, theprogressivephysician.net, and follow him on Twitter at A.W. Gaffney. That's A-W-G-A-F-F-N-E-Y. Joshua Holland, follow Josh on Twitter at J-O-S-H-U-A-H-O-L. He's a contributor to The Nation and Rolling Stone, and he's the host of Politics and Reality Radio. And of course, follow me on Twitter at KT Helps. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. Follow Gabe at Gabe_Pacheco. And use the hashtag KT Helps Show. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S-H-O-W. And we'll see you Monday, September 18th at our live taping of the Katie Halper Show at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue at 7 p.m. with our special guest, Jabari Brisport, running for City Council. Thanks for listening to The Katie Halper Show. Make sure to tune in next Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI for another great episode. You can also find us on SoundCloud and iTunes, where you can rate and review us. Don't forget that we count on your support to bring you our weekly shows. To do that, just go to patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show.
The Katie Halper Show is produced by Florence Burrow Adams and Joshua Bregman. Our theme song is by The Ballet. Thanks for listening.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.